Hi, this is Jennifer Javornik, and you're listening to the Film and Games Podcast. This year, I attended the Games for Change Festival in New York City. Tune in to all the interviews in this series to hear insightful conversations with some of the best minds in educational gaming. I have met some incredible people this week, and I've been really looking forward to this interview. I have a special guest that I think it has going to be really exciting for our community. And I'd love her to introduce herself.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm Rebecca Bengiat. I'm the president and COO of the JED Foundation. And we are a national nonprofit organization that works in suicide prevention and promoting youth mental health.
Awesome. Welcome. So I was talking to another guest who said, like, well, the bad thing that happened in COVID is obviously we saw huge mental health impacts, but the great thing that happened is now is just part of our national conversation. So tell me a little bit about what your foundation is focused on right now and what you're trying to do.
Sure. And it's true. We don't have to make the case anymore around supporting youth mental health. So we have been around for over 20 years. We are a systems change organization, which means that we work in boundary communities. It was a model that was developed in the Air Force originally. And the hypothesis of the model was that if we are able to look at systems level change in boundary communities, we will see reduction in suicide and improvement in mental health.
And so, explain to me a little bit more about what a boundary-based community is.
So a boundary community is a community where we can pull lots of levers. So if you imagine the military, it's a small town. You're eating, sleeping, working, recreating, essentially in a community that has the opportunity to impact policy and procedure and intervention in a really coordinated way if you're able to coordinate it. We look at educational systems through that similar lens. So we've taken that logic model and we have translated it, thinking of higher education, K-12 districts, high schools, as similar boundary communities where young people spend a tremendous amount of time and that there are controlling policies and procedures and interventions that directly affect suicide prevention and mental health. The framework has a component of it that's access to clinical care, but the majority of the framework and the intervention areas that we look to have much more to do with things like social connectedness, so that is a remarkably protective factor against suicide, feelings of belonging, understanding that there are adults who care about you or are interested in your well-being, those additional factors beyond access to healthcare are shown to, when we make those system changes and those improvements, reduce suicide and improve mental health.
That makes so much sense to me because I saw it myself during the pandemic that just at my child's high school, there's just not enough hours. They have one psychologist or one counselor, and there is no way that all the children that needed care were going to be able to access kind of direct one-on-one intervention.
Well, there's certainly needs around pipeline and access to care. So our model doesn't replace that intervention, but we think about all of the other supportive interventions and how they can work in concert because not every student needs a level of clinical care, but they all need to feel like they belong. They all need to feel like they're connected. And so we don't have a thing. We don't do a particular thing in that system. There's not a workbook from JED. There's not a handout. We come into systems, I can use school districts as an example, and do a qualitative and quantitative assessment. So we're coming in and we're looking at all the policies and procedures and interventions that they're using, what's the information they're collecting. We think about proxy metrics because we can't use suicide, thankfully, as a metric. The N is too small, so that's a good thing. But what are the proxy metrics that indicate system health? And then we create a strategic plan, and then we actually provide technical assistance. So we are in the systems over a series of years. We have staff with portfolios of schools and districts and higher education institutions to implement the improvements that we've seen on the strategic plan. And then we measure everything. So we're looking to see, is it working? How do we know it's working? Is that the direct interventions are often couched as cure-alls or couched as sort of easy fixes to really complicated problems. This is a really complicated issue. It deserves complicated intervention. And so we can sit very neutrally in a strategic planning process and technical assistance and say, okay, what is working? This seems to be serving your students well. This seems to be serving your faculty and staff well. This maybe isn't. So let's take a look. And that is the work that we do, informed by a set of research and collaboration and expertise where we go out into the field so we can bring it back into these systems.
Wow. Okay. I'm ready for some like concrete, tangible examples. So without naming any school districts, of course, but I'd love to hear like through these indicators, we know this is the problem and here's the types of interventions we might recommend.
Sure. So for instance, we, as part of our survey process, we ask young people if they feel like there's somebody at their school that cares about them. And that is, it could be anybody. It doesn't have to be the counselor. It doesn't have to be. But that sense of connection is absolutely indicative of their sense of belonging. And we can track through to the evidence-based logic model to understand how students, the level of comfort that the students feel on their campus. If students feel disconnected, if students don't feel like there's an adult that knows their name or cares about them and that's their sensation, even if the system thinks that that's the case, we have good information. And it's not something that's collected typically in usual surveying or conversation with students. Then we look to intervention type. So how did that happen? Is it because we have not helped the adults in the system understand how to identify and recognize students and build those relationships? Maybe they're seeing it, but they don't know what to do, so they're not asking the questions because what if they get an answer that's scary? And what are the interventions that are already in place in the system? It doesn't have to be expensive or new, but sometimes it's just connecting the dots. So some training on how to approach and identify young people and start conversation if you want to build that relationship, how to escalate if you see something that doesn't seem right. So you're not holding the outcome, there's a handoff. All those pathways may exist, but if a student isn't feeling it, then we help draw those lines. So that's a very concrete, not particularly expensive example of that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. And, so where you said you've been around for 20 years, like it seems like your services are like incredible and much needed because I can't imagine that like school administrators aren't particularly well versed or have the right frameworks or kind of what do you see out there?
There is interest and wild demand on time, right? So that we already require so much of educators. We require so much of the adults who are serving young people. And our intention is not to add to that burden. It is to identify and find ease and synergy and really keep from spending time on interventions that may not be serving the outcomes that we're looking for. So, and we don't expect day-to-day administrators to necessarily have the bandwidth to do the work that we're doing, which is why we work in concert. We also find that the opportunity, you talk a lot about sort of social connectedness and collaboration, we are able to connect nationally administrators in very similar seats. So having superintendents talk to each other across the country, having faculty and staff have connection, there are learnings and outcomes. One conversation where the superintendent from Montana talking to someone from Alabama about a particular implementation for clinical care. And it was, if we hadn't been able to set up that conversation, there's no reason why they would have ever come across each other. And so it's not to be a burden, and it's not for lack of wanting the assistance. And it is translatable and applicable in every setting. So it is not politicized. Everybody wants their child to feel loved and safe and connected. And that's the core of the work. And so from an entry point perspective, there's not a barrier to intervention type, because that's it regresses back to the mean. That's what we're all driving towards.
What brings you to Games for Change? I'm now
Why
so
am I
curious.
Here? Why are we here? This is the so we know a couple of things. We know that young people don't just exist in boundary communities. And that's been a shift that's happened over decades, right? So that there are more and more porous boundaries to what is in and outside of the school setting. And we see that both through as it pushes out and as it pushes in. So educational tools moving out and pushing into systems. So we additionally to our academic programs work, we think a lot about attitude and behavior change. Our demographic is 13 to 30, because we think a lot about that transition into adulthood, the developmental shifts into adulthood. You're not done when you graduate from college or after you're 23. And so we look at this window and think about what does it mean to provide those same feelings of safety and guardrails and forward-looking thinking to communities that might not be in the school system but are boundaried in different ways. And one place where we think, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about in the digital landscape. So we got thinking about, and it's a conversation that comes up in the school systems, right? So we have administrators saying, I think it's a concern that's not new. So anytime there's a new technology, right, there's concern about what it means for young people. And not necessarily focused on the benefits, right? So the language is often very much around risk. And so what new thing is this going to bring to our young people and sort of the terrible things that are coming? We know that there are protective factors, similar to what we see in the school system, to community, sub-community in the digital space, right? And we certainly saw that during COVID. So we are interested in understanding and talking about, in complicated ways, I think it's okay to say that there's no easy solve to this, and be future-looking with conversations as it relates to social media and, in this case, to the metaverse. And what does it mean to have young people in a metaverse setting? What does that even mean? And how are we even talking about that? And what are those protective factors, and are they same different? And then how do we navigate and prioritize our work at GED, but really the work in the field to make sure that we're safeguarding youth mental health in these contexts?
That is so interesting. So are you saying, like, this is what you're starting to look at, or have you been looking at it for long enough that you've come to some conclusions?
So we are always curious. We're just very curious. We ask a million questions. We're always asking questions, and started really asking questions about a year ago around metaverse, particularly, similar to other veins of sort of curiosity that we've had, and have known, of course, of Games for Change and Raising Good Gamers for some time. Therefore, we're all hanging out in the same landscape, and so as these questions were emerging, we reached out and said, can we partner, collaborate, who can be smart at the table to help us think through how we need to position this emerging technology, fill in the blank, vis-a-vis all of the stakeholders, including educators. So that really kicked off about a year ago, and we've just released our report this week.
Oh, great. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that
what are the highlights?
Sure. So we grounded this work in a couple of ways. First, through a literature review that the Connected Learning Lab conducted on behalf of this work. That's getting published a little bit later this summer. That's coming. It's fantastic. Because we needed to know what we know. And so the answer was not a whole lot on the metaverse, but a whole lot about social media and what are the parallels and analogs. And using that framework of the literature review, convened a panel of just the most remarkable national experts from, it was really cross-industry and expertise, It wasn't, you know, those Zooms where you're sitting there and there's sort of silence hangs because you asked. We never had that. That was never a silence did not hang in these rooms. This was a great room.
People had opinions.
We did not worry about filling the time with these groups. So convened a series of advisory group meetings to first reflect on how we might synthesize the literature review, come up with a set of driving principles. And then we landed, there was an interesting middle piece that emerged really quickly, that we needed to frame recommendations. The intention was to have recommendations that are actionable, and we do. So the reason that we landed on actionable is so that we could take snackable bites and push it out to the world. We needed to ground those in the point of view of young people, but not just the point of view. We developed a rights framework. So really thinking about what are the rights of youth, what do they deserve in a metaverse space, and what does that mean for their mental health? And so the most interesting piece of this work really came about in the development of those rights. We had a bunch of grown-ups at the table, smart, wonderful, right? But grown-ups, as right, not the probably technical term for the folk in the room, but they're right. And we had a youth advisory group that came in to review and push back. Again, no silences in those Zooms. That was not a quiet Zoom. The rights that we developed in those initial meetings landed really quite almost perfectly with young people. And there was
a job, grown-ups.
You never know. And what it said was that there was a understanding and connection and embodiment in the work that's happening out in the field of what those rights are, and that proved true. Everyone wordsmiths and we pushed back and forth, but we did not get wild reactions that we were off track. So as we're developing recommendations, rights, surfacing to youth and stakeholders, we found points of leverage and priority. So the easy thing to do is to point fingers, cross stakeholder, right? Oh, this is really the responsibility of caregivers. This is the responsibility of developers. This educators really should. And no one's going to fix it on their own. And no one group is to blame. And there's wild opportunity to do really, really wonderful protective things. So we were able to identify points of synergy within those intersections of stakeholder. And I think that's the most exciting thing about this work, because it allows for clear direction around these folks need to collaborate on these things. These folks need to move over here and collaborate, in addition to sets of activities that really are stakeholder specific.
Can you give me like one, two, or three examples of the rights?
So,
like, how many are there in total?
There are 6 or 7 rights.
Okay.
I don't have them in front of me, but the idea that young people deserve to have spaces, I'll paraphrase here, where they know the rules, where the rules are clear and the rules of engagement are clear, and the folk who are in those spaces understand the rules of engagement, that they have the opportunity to be themselves so that there is a self-expression, freedom for self-expression in spaces that's protected. Freedom from being taken advantage of. So understanding what is the data collection and algorithms, especially as we look to younger users, and baking in protections for them. They are acutely aware of the information that's flowing and being watched, as it were. So those are, and none of them are terrible surprises, but they, I would say the piece too that was the most future looking, they want to be able to create new spaces. And so they want engagement and they want to have a seat at the table. And we asked them, it was a group of 16 to 24 year olds, and to envision 5 years into the future. I mean, which is can be a lift when you're right to sort of think about what your early 20s might look like. They all imagined that they would have a seat at that table moving forward, and that they wanted that for their younger selves. And so part of the beauty of the conversation with them is they were able to really look forward and look back. What do they wish they had? And what do they hope they're going to have access to?
I know there's a lot of people who are going to listen to this podcast who would love to access the report. How would they get it?
So it's available for download at jedfoundation.org/metaverse. And there are additional assets that are available alongside, but that is, it's a free set of recommendations. And we really hope that it is, accessed and used widely. There's a lot of good. There's a lot of good there.
What's your takeaways from Games for Change this year? Is it the first time you're attending?
It's the first time I've been here. We have been here organizationally. There's a slightly different energy. I feel like there is a good. I'm glad that you're not.
I agree with that. It feels different this year.
It feels different. There's a sort of get to work energy that feels, not that it hasn't ever been sort of about what's coming next, but a let's get these things done and taken care of. So my sense is, at least what I've attended, we've moved a little bit even more out of theory and into practice. And I'm just, it's fantastic.
I think part of why you're getting that feeling is like, it's very, being here, it's very clear that Games for Change's efforts to grow internationally have panned out.
Yes.
I can't believe how many people I'm meeting who flew here from different countries and different parts of the world who are really engaged in the work. And that's, you know, in the U.S., we can get very U.S.-centric,
yes.
thinking we're the creators for the world, and clearly we're not. So I've really appreciated that. I think the other thing is, you know, we are a small part of the video game industry at large. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, as I'm listening to you, what's going through my head is it's really, you know, we are the saintly aspect of the larger video game community. Most of us are not making games with violence, and most of us are, I guess, there is serious game content about war, but generally it's about kind of the impacts of war, right? We're not, usually there's not battle games, and you know, we think as developers that we're so conscious of the spaces that we create, and we are. However, we're not immune to our biases. We're not immune to our preferences, biases, and points of view. So I really appreciate that organizations like the Jed Foundation, I know Able Gamers is here, I know the Gina Davis Institute, like, I'm so glad that you've all taken time to come to us, because it would be easy for us to say, like, well, we're not the problem, but I know just by definition that we're part of the problem, just because we're human.
Well, and there are solutions and there are interventions, and it does not require an either or. It's not profit or engagement or. It is easily integrated, and that's what's so exciting for us, to be able to show up in spaces where we may not typically have been previous, to have those conversations with the folk who are doing the work in these new boundaried communities.
Right. That makes sense to me. So what does the data, I'm just curious, like, what is the data? I know there was some, like, a Surgeon General's report, and there was some data that came out during COVID. How are we trending for the youth, teen mental health in the United States?
Things are tough. Things are tough for young people. And we think, for a couple of different reasons. So certainly COVID had impact on young people. Some young people also fared well, right? So the idea of being more, right? So we don't want to make totally blanket statements, but it was very difficult, no surprise. And there's an additional burden, I would say, generationally. We have all sorts of societal factors at play and visibility to societal factors that I don't think were present generationally. So systemic racism, inequitable housing, education, there are just environment, climate change. So we are having a generation of young people who are reasonably stressed, anxious, depressed for many, many things that are outside of their own control, in addition to their what might be in their control. If we're saying to them, use an individual solution, meditate, even therapy, they're reflecting back to us, the world's on fire. That is not why we're anxious. We're anxious because we have a reason to be anxious. So a lot of our communication and approach with young people needs to include an understanding of what's happening in their environments in the world, because otherwise interventions are going to fall flat. And so we think a lot about the increase vis-a-vis what's happening in their personal experience and what's happening, you know, writ large.
It makes so much sense to me. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I've learned a lot of new things on the by talking to you, and I'm really looking forward to reading the report.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thanks for listening to the Filament Games podcast. If you'd like to hear more about games, game-based learning, and what's happening at our studio, subscribe today on iTunes or Stitcher. And be sure to visit us at our website, filamentgames.com.